name is Andrea Kleinman. I'm an account executive here at WGN Radio. I'll never forget my first summer job. I worked at She Boutique, and I was asked to mop the floors with the wet Swiffer. When I tried to dip the dry Swiffer into the bucket of water, I quickly realized that the water is already part of the Swiffer, and there is no bucket needed. True story. One Summer Chicago is ready to give 30,000 teens and young adults summer employment, but we need your donation to make that possible. Visit onesummerchicago.org/donate or call 800-931-5707. That's 800-931-5707. One Summer Chicago 2017 is a fund of the Robert R. McCormick Foundation.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Doing my best.
Here's John Williams.
There we go. It's 110. All the way until 3. It's just a little two-hour show we do here on the John Williams Show. We really appreciate your tuning in, calling and texting as we move our way along. Lots of strange, unsettling ground to cover today. Stacey St. Clair, the columnist for the Chicago Tribune and reporter, will join us. She's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Her page one story today, Scared to Death, is about a Naperville teen who committed suicide. It's a topic I wouldn't normally spend much time on. I just don't normally go to that particular subject, but I will today. Her reporting and writing is so good, and there may be something that we should all learn from this story. If you read it, it was most of the first page of the Chicago Tribune today. And I kind of noticed that the first page of the Tribune wasn't all about what happened in Manchester. To be clear, they covered it. And the story broke late yesterday, but in enough time for the newspaper to completely redo its front page if they wanted. They chose to keep Stacey's story front and center. I don't have a lot to say about what happened in Manchester. I feel like you do. It's just so senseless, and it is so terrible. I was at the Cubs game last night, and as my friend Mark and I were actually going into the game, you know, we had to do the thing where you drop your keys and your cell phone, and it goes around the outside of the machine, and then you walk through, kind of like you do at the airport, hope it doesn't beep. If it does, they wand you. Otherwise, you get your keys back. And it all seems sort of silly and pointless, but it's not, I guess, right? That little song and dance we do has a purpose. And every now and then you see people getting ticked or getting outraged or complaining about that. We do that at airports. We do that at concerts. We do it at Cubs games. And we need to stay ever vigilant. At the same time, this is what life is like on Earth these days. And I hope that we do stamp it out. But I'm not real optimistic about our chances. And if we never stamp it out, I think the question is, what do we do about that? What do we do with our lives as a result? And for me, the takeaway is you still go to Ariana Grande concerts. By the way, her tour has not been canceled. The show does go on, as I think it should. You know, I think about this when there's an explosion in Belgium or Paris or Turkey or England. I've been to almost all of those cities and countries in the last few years. Brenda and I travel a little bit with WGN listeners. You know, Steve Bertrand does too. And I think it's a greater shame still if, out of fear or caution, we decide we're not going to go to the games, we're not going to go to the concerts, we're not going to get on that plane and travel to a city that is safer than the one we left, by the way. So life just has to go on. And you try and be as dignified and as smart and as cautious as you can be about it. This guy, David Levitt, is getting some attention today, and it doesn't deserve much here or anywhere, really. But he's some funny guy who freelance tweets. He freelances for CBS, among other sources. And so yesterday, as the thing was going down, he was on Twitter. And one of the first things he tweeted was this: multiple confirmed fatalities at Manchester Arena. The last time I listened to Ariana Grande, I almost died too. And then people immediately started to retweet that, screen grab it, and share it. I guess that's the same as retweet it, right? And quote tweet it. And those were saying, dude, apologize, take it down, and then go away, because you're going to end your career if you keep doing this. To say nothing of the fact that you're just being insanely insensitive to people. He also tweeted, honestly, for over a year, I thought an Ariana Grande was something that you ordered at Starbucks. And I was following this last night. Maybe you were too, just as Twitter was pouring in. And at one point, I thought I saw a tweet from him that said, seriously, when I first put the tweet up, one of those, maybe both of them, I did not realize how serious things were. I'm not sure how truthful that is, since the very, very first thing you heard was from the police saying multiple fatalities, and that's included in one of his tweets. And now he's tweeting up a storm. Eventually, he took it down. He said, okay, I finally took it down because so many people asked. I think he thought that, you know, he should be honest about it. If he sinned, don't hide it, and then just deal with it. And so he has been. He's been tweeting up funny things about, you know, a GIF like, this is what Tuesdays feel like, and it's a Star Wars monster falling over, or it's something else. People make mistakes with their phones all the time, and I don't know what this guy's deal is, but he's dealing with it today. He said, I now know what President Trump feels like after a bad tweet. He's now asking people to donate to the American Red Cross. He's now acknowledging through a whole series of videos stuff that is, I'm sorry, but then also random stuff too, like, is it possible to cry underwater? David Levitt moves on, and I guess I will too. It's 1:16 on WGN. Well, actually, it was just a couple of other points I think I wanted to make. Let me make sure I got everything said that I need to say for now. Yeah. Chris Jones, who I guess is from Manchester, is going to swing through our studio in the 2 o'clock hour. And we'll also do our After Schools Matter interview. Most of the shows, I think all of us are taking a turn today, talking a little bit about how you can make a donation to an organization that will help pay for transportation costs and stipends for, maybe even salaries for, the, you know, hourly wage for young men and women in the Chicago area who could use a summer job. Not only is the cash good for them, the experience is good for them, the work they do is good for all of us. And we're all behind that big time here at WGN Radio. You see this news from the NFL today? They have the annual meetings for the NFL. And one of the rules that they're not going to allow is one of my favorite things which have evolved in the league over the last, I don't know, couple of years. You seem to see it more. Who's that over in sports over there? Can a brother get a little help from the sports department? I think that's Kevin over there, but I don't think he's listening. It says new rules prohibit the leaper block attempt, which is a top priority for our players. I love the leaper block, if it's what I think it is. It's where you run up, you jump over the line of scrimmage, and you block a field goal or an extra point. What is the harm of that? That's an awesome thing that they do. The commissioner of the NFL also said this. By the way, Kevin, do you like the leaper block?
Yeah, I think it's one of the more fun plays in football. Of course, they're going to say it's for safety concerns.
Safety schmafety. All you're doing is, look, every play in the NFL is a dangerous play.
Right.
This is relatively safe. You just ain't nobody doing. You just jump over everybody, and then you stand in front of the kicker, and he kicks the ball as hard as he possibly can into your testicles. That's the leaper block play. That's how that goes.
I love the leaper block play.
It's
and that's what they call it in the huddle as well, guys. It's
really
the leaper block play.
I'll bet they don't. But it's so simple and it works. And maybe the problem is that you could, once they figure that out, ain't nobody going to be kicking field goals anymore. And sometimes you need field goals. But I think that's the league's problem. You could move the kicker back even further if you want. You know, just make it more difficult for the leaper to leap over the line of scrimmage. The deal is you've got to time it so that you leap over just as the ball's being snapped. You can't leapfrog over your players. You can't use their backs or butts as sort of a step to jump higher still. Mm-hmm. They can't hoist you into the air. But if you're just long, tall, and athletic enough, you can jump over the line of scrimmage just as the ball's being snapped and then hurdle yourself into the foot of the kicker. I say more power to you.
Well, Seahawks linebacker Bobby Wagner a while back tweeted about this, saying, we are creative. We will find another way. And I hope they do, because this seems like one of those instances that it doesn't happen very often. I mean, how many? I don't think it happened once last year. Maybe happens once a season at most.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't see it.
It seems to me like I saw more than that, but you're the
expert.
Okay,
well, I mean, maybe it is a few times, but if it does happen once, you're going to see it on repeat on highlights for the entire season. So maybe you see a lot of clips of it. To me, it's one of those instances that happens just not often a lot, and then the league takes these drastic measures to eliminate a fun play when, you know, and they express their concern for safety and that a player may be flipped in the air and land on their head or land awkwardly, where to me it's only going to happen once or twice, and if somebody does this right, they're not going to hurt themselves. It'll just be a fun play to see.
It's virtually a non-contact play. I mean,
exactly.
Think about it. Think about the collisions and the danger in the league. This is not on my list of things to fix.
This is why people call it the No Fun League.
Well, so they address that. Today we are excited to tell you, says the commissioner, today we are excited to tell you about another change that comes after conversations with more than 80 current and former players. We are relaxing our rules on celebrations to allow players more room to have fun after they make big plays. We know that you love the spontaneous displays of emotion that come after a spectacular touchdown. I'll come back to that sentence in a minute. And players have told us they want more freedom to be able to express themselves and celebrate their athletic achievements. So here are a few examples of celebrations that will be allowed after scores under the new policy. Celebrating on the ground. You can make snow angels, stuff like that. Using the football as a prop after a TD. You and some of your best friends on the team have orchestrated a little pantomime with the ball. You get to do that still. Your little one-act play. Mm-hmm. Group demonstrations, as I just described, will also be allowed. Things that will not be allowed, besides the leaper block, any demonstrations that are deemed offensive, prolonged, and delay the game, or are directed at an opponent. You can't stick it in their face. But if y'all want to do your little dance, we're okay with that. So the icky shuffle is back.
Huge. And the Dirty Bird, remember the Falcons? They used to get in the circle back in the
90s. Oh, God, that's right.
That was a fun one.
I love all that stuff. I'm excited.
Exactly.
Okay, I don't.
Really?
I don't. Because I'm old. I don't know
I'm
why.
I'm old, too, but I like to have fun when I go to a football game.
Here is my attitude about things like this. Did Walter Payton do stuff like this? Answer me that question. How many times did Walter Payton do an end zone dance? Can you think of a time Walter Payton did the Walter Payton thing? What was the Walter Payton thing? The Walter Payton thing was he got back up. That was the Walter Payton thing.
Well, he did participate in a song singing about winning the Super Bowl before they had won the actual
Super Bowl. Shuffle was... Touche, sir. Good point.
And as a Packer fan, there's nothing better than a good Lambo leap.
You know,
John.
I know, the Lambo leap, if of them all, the Lambo leap is the best. I totally get that. But all right, what if after I score a touchdown, I've secretly hidden a Sharpie in the padding around the goalpost. I take that out and then autograph the football and then flip it to somebody. Loving that?
Pull it Terrell Owens. I love it.
I'm good with that.
But
see, to your point, John, to them, that's not really rubbing it in the face of their opponent. That's them just having fun.
I know
and,
that.
And it being excited. I think to the point that Commissioner Goodell said, you know, when it's offensive or trying to embarrass your opponents, I think that's sort of a fine line. Because if a guy is pulling a Sharpie out of the end zone pad, couldn't that be considered embarrassing to their opponents? So we'll see how they're going to dictate this on the field.
I feel bad for the refs who have to determine what's going too far.
Because I'm
going
to come right up to the referee and go, that hurt my feelings. Mr. Referee, sir, could you please blow that whistle?
I feel embarrassed, please.
How does that make me feel as a person? Okay, do you even consider that when you let them do these dances?
Right. Well, remember the, I think it was Terrell Owens again, who ran to the midfield at Cowboys Stadium.
Yes, and I'm thinking of that.
Took a knee in the star.
And then what happened to him after that?
Right, and then he was leveled by
He got plowed. The thing is, it's not so much how the opponent feels. To me, it is how do your teammates feel. And I guess your teammates are happy for you. But it's as if you hiked the ball to the quarterback, blocked everybody, ran down the field, and you manufactured the helmet too. You did everything, and now it's all about you. That's the thing that bothers me most about end zone and other celebrations
if I can hop on your bandwagon, on your side of this.
Go ahead. There's plenty of room up here on the John Williams bandwagon.
So, you know, there's a lot of little kids watching this football they just idolize all these players, and you have to make sure that they still have good sportsmanships and that these little kids learn the right way to play sports and be a good sport.
By the way, this text is just poured in. Walter Payton threw the football into the stands once or twice. Yeah, I guess he did, but that was not his thing. But he did spin the football like a top in the end zone. And yes, he would. He which was amazing because he could get that thing to spin. But I'm going to allow that. That's okay with me. You may have something to say. OneSummerChicago.org/donate. OneSummerChicago.org/donate is how you can make a donation to the program we're featuring today. We'll talk more about this 1 hour from now in our 2 o'clock hour. You can also make a donation by phone. Get your credit card out, 1-800-931-5707. You can call that number right now, 1-800-931-5707. One Summer Chicago 2017. It is a McCormick Foundation fund. It helps to keep teens and young adults safe, learning, and engaged this summer. Your donation to One Summer Chicago 2017 supports all sorts of local nonprofits that have jobs or activities for teens to do over the course of the summer. Tens of thousands of them will be engaged. Thanks to your generosity, if you can make a donation right now, OneSummerChicago.org/donate. Naperville teen's senseless death is the headline of a page one story by Stacy St. Clair, who is in our studio today. Stacy and I have talked many times, and I appreciate you coming into the studio this afternoon. Stacy, how are you?
Good, how are you?
My goodness, what a story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I've been in journalism for 20 years, and I think it's probably the toughest one I've had to write and cover.
Had you been following the story of this young boy, Corey Walgren, for some time?
Yeah, I live in Naperville. So it was a story everybody in Naperville was sort of whispering about, but I couldn't find out exactly what happened, and things I heard didn't seem quite right. So I started digging around, and I started with, you know, getting his coroner's report and reading the details there, and then getting police reports.
You had to use a Freedom of Information request?
I did, yeah.
Why are they that way about that?
Well, with the coroner's report, that's just sort of standard. They didn't put up any fight. You know, I filed an Freedom of Information Act request. They turned it over. With the Naval Police Department, there was some back and forth. They were not really interested in first and in turning anything over.
Sure.
And I pushed back a little bit, and the Tribune pushed back, and they turned over some documents, and then from there I had a pretty good sense of what had happened. Then I started doing like further reporting in the community.
What happened to this young man?
So Corey Walgren was a 16-year-old junior at Naperville North High School, and he, on the morning, or the, I guess, 1 o'clock lunchtime on January 11th, was called into the dean's office at the school, and he was asked about a recording that was on his cell phone of a consensual sexual encounter that he'd had with a female classmate.
Who is also 16.
She had found out about the recording that day, and according to reports, was mortified about it, did not know it existed, and she went to her dean and complain about it, and then Corey was called in.
She complained because he was also sharing it with his friends.
She believed he was sharing it with,
fair enough,
with his friends.
Yeah.
And so they called Corey into a room with a Naperville police officer who was assigned to the school, and another dean, and they talked to him, according to the police reports, for 18 minutes. They've referred to it as a child pornography investigation in public documents. He handed over his phone. They said he was cooperative, that he was forthright. They called his, then after talking to him for 18 minutes, called his mother, told his mother that it was a child's pornography investigation, and that it was possible that Corey could end up on the state sex offender.
And they're calling
issue.
A child, right, and they told him and her that you could be now listed as a child sexual offender?
Correct. That's what Mrs. Walgren says.
And it's child pornography because the young lady is 16.
Because they're both 16.
Yeah.
And what it turned out, though, I should clarify, the recording turned out to be in actuality was audio of the encounter, which is still should not have, you know, been recorded, but it was not it was not child pornography. There were no pornographic images found.
Oh, no kidding. The definition does not include audio.
It does not.
Because it is a video, but you can't see.
Correct.
It's
sort of as if the when the phone recorded it, the lens was placed down So it's dark.
So you just hear the sounds of
you
the two
sounds.
Of them. And he's playing this for his friends. She calls the dean. She's mortified. They call him in. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe their tactics to him?
Well, the school district and the police department say they acted responsibly and within their procedures. The family disagrees. You know, his mom told me that she thinks that they were trying to scare him straight, and instead they scared him to death because after he hung up the phone with the mom and mentioned the sex offender registry.
The dean
and the police officer, they left Corey alone. And he then got up and walked out of school and walked about a mile to downtown Naperville and killed himself from the top of a parking deck.
Jumped off a 50-foot-high
yeah.
parking deck.
Yep.
The girl has not cooperated with your story. Her family did not cooperate with the story.
I could not reach her. So they didn't decline to cooperate. We were not able to reach her parents. And it was important to me to talk to her parents first before I could speak with her.
Is it the thrust of the story? Is it your point that the school mishandled it, that they should have not terrified this young man so much so that he felt like his life was over?
His parents definitely believe that. Illinois state law, there are some exceptions, but says that a minor should not be interrogated by a police officer without parental notification. There are exceptions if they think, you know, there is an existing, you know, danger, there's immediate safety concern.
Yeah, why wasn't his mother or father in there during this sort of explanation of, young man, your life here is in serious, you know, change?
That's a question only the school can answer. Because when they called his mother, she said, I'm leaving work right away and I will be there.
Right. They first tried to reach the father. They couldn't. They then tried to reach the mother. They did. She said, I'll be there in 50 minutes. She was there much quicker than that.
She went right there.
But had they already talked to him prior to that or no?
The police officer and the dean, we know from the police records, spoke with Corey by himself for 18 minutes.
Right. And then was there there was never a communal meeting. She never saw Corey.
There was a communal speakerphone conversation where they said, hey, Corey's in trouble. This is a child pornography investigation, you know, potential.
Can you imagine getting that phone call? Did he have any history of anxiety or mental illness?
No, according to the coroner's report and the police reports, he had no history of mental illness, had never shown any signs of suicide. His friends told me he was joking around at lunch.
No drug and alcohol abuse?
Never been in trouble in school. His friends said he was joking around at the lunch table up until the moment he was asked to come to the office.
Hmm. So then he comes into the office. This happens, and then he walks off the campus.
Right.
And presumably does that voluntarily, that it is a suicide.
Yes. It's ruled a suicide by the coroner.
Stacey, don't you think, though, when you hear stories of suicide, be it a famous grunge rocker last week mm-hmm. or somebody that we've never heard of before, that it almost always has to be something underlying it other than that last thing that pushed them over, that you or I wouldn't commit suicide because we're not predisposed? Some people maybe are. You can't always. That's why we tell people when a loved one commits suicide, there's nothing you could have done about it or it's not your fault. So even though he did not show any history, I wonder how fair, quote unquote, blaming the school or the police is for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I certainly can't. I'm not a psychologist. I wasn't his psychologist. I can't get into
your story doesn't blame them either. I'm just thinking out loud here.
Sort of lays the facts out. I think his parents are questioning, you know, why you would, you know, if that was the thing that sent him over. And I think they would argue that there was nothing before that. But even if there were, why was he interrogated by himself? And then why was he left alone after he was interrogated.
Right. So then why was he allowed to wander off campus, having just... And here's a young man who gets good grades. He's on the hockey team. Mm-hmm. The only guy on the hockey team to never have a penalty minute.
Yes.
The guy that organized fun things for the boys. He was doing all the things that you hope your kids would do. He confessed to his parents, this is an interesting part of your story, just a week before that he had had a sexual encounter. I don't know if it was the same one or the same girl. But this is the kind of young man who's actually having a conversation with his parents about that.
Right. I mean... So then you have to say, okay, well, one fear he couldn't have had in his mind is like, what are my parents going to do when they find out I'm having sex?
Because he'd already had that
conversation with his parents. And his parents said, like, you know, look, it wasn't a comfortable conversation and it wasn't a fun conversation by any means, but we had it.
His mother said we weren't proud of that. And I thought, oh, I of course you're not proud of it, but I actually think it's terrific if you have a relationship with a young man such that at the age of 16, he'll sit down and talk to you about that.
Right. And I think that shows, the reason why I included that in the story, because I think it shows the relationship he had with his parents.
You also said that they had numerous conversations with him. His mom, like many of us, were always pointing out to our children things that happen in the world and say, now don't let that happen. Don't be this. Don't do that.
Right.
See what happened here. So they were always prodding him in the right direction. And then he wanders off the campus and takes his own life.
Mm-hmm.
You may have read the story today, page one, Naperville teen's senseless death in the Chicago Tribune. Stacy St. Clair is in our studio. Your question or comment, my number is 312-981-7200. A few of you have something to say about this story. Next on WGN. Okay, it's 1:52. All of our phone lines are busy with calls for Stacy St. Clair, Chicago Tribune reporter. Page one today, you saw the grief-stricken parents who, months later now, are still dealing with the death of their 16-year-old son by suicide, Naperville teen's senseless death. There are Maureen Walgren and her husband, Doug. Their sorry son, Corey, took his own life. After an investigation at the school, they said, you've got pornography on your phone. It was consensual sex between him and another 16-year-old girl. But the consequences of this now were presented to him perhaps as so dire that the devastated young man wandered off campus and took his own life. And we have lots of phone calls for you, Stacy. We'll start with Teresa. You're on WGN. Teresa, what did you want to say? You're on the air.
Well, first of all, we know that teenagers have poor impulse control and their brain is not developed to process things like an adult. Yeah. But you take a child into a room and you bully him. You tell him the worst case scenario is going to happen to him and his whole life is going to be ruined. And then you're surprised that he walked away and did that? It's the school and the police department's fault that this happened. They should have waited till a parent got there. And why would you give somebody, I mean, he was proven guilty before he was even brought into a court. He didn't get that opportunity, even if they did find something on him, and they gave him that your life is ruined.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Teresa. Lots of calls. I'm going to let Stacy comment and then move on to another one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how his parents view it, that he was sort of given the worst-case scenario. The police did put in their reports that they never intended to charge him with a crime, that they were going to do what's called a station adjustment.
Did they explain that to him?
They explained it to his mother, and she said she understood, but she also, at the same time, still had sex offender registry ringing in her head.
But you did not just say that they'd explained it to him.
He was on that speaker.
He was on that
phone.
Call.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Teresa. And your point, too, by the way, is that everybody needs to what? I mean, so is this a conversation we need to have with our kids?
Yeah, I think everyone should have a conversation.
And how does that conversation go?
I think I almost think the conversation, not to, you know, promote the Tribune, but I'm going to approach the Tribune. I would say, read the story and let's talk about it. Because from start to finish, I think there are teachable moments.
I would. My answer to my own question is I want to impress upon my kids, nothing so bad can happen that we can't resolve it or manage it.
Right.
Don't think this is a burden you have to carry on your own. Teresa, thanks for the call. Kevin, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Your last caller really hit all the high points for me, except she missed one. This young man was the epitome of the good kid. He was everybody's friend. He was the organizer of his friends, his brothers and sisters. He didn't do anything wrong. And when they came down on him this hard, when you're dealing with a teenage mind, that was the end of his world.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the call. Comment from you?
You know, I think even his parents would agree that the recording was wrong.
The sharing was wrong.
Right.
And I mean, that's against the law.
The recording of audio is without someone's consent is a crime in Illinois. It is not child pornography. But I think, you know, that's one thing I really appreciated about the Walgreens in talking to me about this story is they never tried to sugarcoat what happened and what led to him being in that dean's office, because they're not proud of that, and they were upset about it. In fact, his mom told me that on the way over to the school, her thoughts alternated between, like, please God, don't let this be as bad as I think it is, and then also, I am going to wring his neck.
How many of us have thought that? If we survive this, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
Parents have said that to themselves before. Kevin, great point. Thanks for the call. This is Rob. You're on the air. Go ahead, Rob.
You know, I totally agree with everything that these other listeners are talking about. But number one, you have the law that they push themselves onto people and interrogate them and push them to scare them and to deal with the fragile mind of a 16-year-old. I mean, I have five kids. My son just graduated. He's 17. He's going to go in the Marine Corps. He's going to be scared to hell when he goes there. But you deal with something like this with the police and them interrogate, no more, they broke the law. They should know better. Even the school should have known better.
The cops did.
The cops and the school. Well, the cops probably pushed the school to also go along with them.
Well, let me ask you both. Rob, hold on a second.
Stacey,
is it your estimation that that was the point? Rob just said they tried to scare this kid. Was that what they were doing?
That is part of the idea of a station adjustment, is to make the juvenile understand the severity of the crime without giving them a criminal record. So in station adjustments, I think by their very nature, are a little bit of, we're gonna scare you. But, as like I said, Corey's mom said, they ended up scaring him to death.
It's page one in today's Chicago Tribune. Buy a copy. You can read it online. Stacy's email address and Twitter handle are there if you want to further reach out to her and talk about it. And as I suspect, this isn't the last time you're going to end up reporting on this story.
No.
Let's make a point to have a longer conversation and take
Absolutely.
More calls. We're getting lots of texts and phone calls about it. Stacy St. Clair says, if you have a young person in your world, get them to read this story and then talk to them about it. Thanks, Stacy.
Thanks.
News is next on WGN.
This is Bill Murdoch, and I'm the chief engineer here at WGN Radio. A summer job I'll never forget was working up at camp in Elko, Wisconsin for 4 summers, and I taught scouts how to swim, how to sail, how to row boats, how to canoe, how to kayak. The weather was good sometimes and bad sometimes. The food was incredible sometimes and really scary other times. It was a good time, and we will never forget it. One Summer Chicago is ready to give 30,000 teens and young adults summer employment, but we need your donation to make that possible. Visit onesummerchicago.org/donate or call 800-931-5707. That's 800-931-5707. One Summer Chicago 2017 is a fund of the Robert R. McCormick Foundation.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Now, this is me. I'm going to give you that phone number one more time. This radiothon has everything going for it, but tote bags and ringing telephones in the background. But that's what we're trying to do today. So if you can, please do now. Make a donation to onesummerchicago.org. That's onesummerchicago.org/donate. By phone, call 1-800-931-5707. More about that in a few minutes. In this city that works, there's nothing more important than working. We're trying to help 31,000 teens and young adults find work this summer. That's what this is all about. Speaking of a city that works, Chris Jones is in our studio. He is the, what's your exact title? What kind of critic are you?
Critic, theater, columnist, Sunday columnist.
At the Chicago Tribune. In fact, 2 stories by you today, your sort of overview of the circus closing.
Yeah, it was a sad night.
Yeah, no kidding. And yet I saw last night on Twitter, you say, as a person from Manchester, our hearts and prayers go out to everybody.
Yeah.
I knew you were a Brit. I didn't know you were from Manchester.
Yeah, born and raised.
What's Manchester like?
Well, I always think it's actually not unlike Chicago, which has been my home for a long time now. And the two cities have a lot in common. They're both proud cities. They're second cities, and they define themselves to a large extent in opposition to the first city in London or New York. And they both have this proud tradition of working class people. I mean, Manchester really was arguably the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. It's an incredibly friendly place. It's just the people there are just spectacularly beautiful. It's that, you know, we Northerners sort of, you know, we cast aspersions on the South in England, and it's the people of Manchester are unique. And the city is like, just like Chicago, has gone through a transformation from a gritty industrial city. My father was actually born where this arena, where this incident took place. My father was born sort of around the corner from there, and sort of his sort of slum street has been
really
cleared, and they've done all this new development.
It's described
there
as one of the largest arenas of its type in the world.
20,000 people. But when I was a kid, it was all working class houses, so terraced houses that were all knocked down and been sort of redone. Just like the city. And the city has, there's also this pain of it being a music event in that city, because you think of the Manchester scene and Tony Wilson and all this sort of great music and art, an incredible club scene in Manchester. And just a city that, like Chicago, that has a proud culture distinct from anywhere else.
Is it also undergoing some of the same immigration evolution that European and U.S. cities are?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think, the fact that the suspect in this attack is apparently a British national and from Manchester, from, I gather, not very far away from the arena itself, which I kind of had a feeling would turn out to be the case last night.
Why do you say that?
Well, I just knowing that you know, so often that these attacks are actually perpetrated by nationals of the country where they take place. People often assume they're immigrants, and they're often not, because the world is sort of complicated and people's allegiances is complicated. And I think it's fair to say that Manchester over the years has had troubles in integrating those changes in its demographic. Many of Manchester is surrounded by small mill towns, cotton towns, really, that were existed around textile mills. And, of course, that all went away, and the population began to change. There was the sort of a combination of welcomingness and resentment, I think is fair to say.
Yeah.
I don't know that who knows what was going on in this guy's head, but I mean, I don't know that it was anything to do with Manchester. I suspect, my gut feeling would say, that it was to do with issues well beyond the city itself. The city just has to pay the price of it, you know, John.
That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
You hate to be one of those benchmark cities, like you remember a city in Belgium, or you remember Paris, or you remember Istanbul, large international cities. Manchester's in that league, maybe a little smaller than some of them, but this is going to now be remembered as the Manchester story.
Well, it's also, I think if you're a parent, as I am, I've got a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I was telling, who've been, you know, I've taken them to Manchester lots of times, and I was trying to explain this to them this morning. And, you know, my 12-year-old said that when Ariana Grande was here, that most of his class had gone to that concert. He said, I think I knew 30 people who'd gone.
Yeah.
So I said, well, you know, if we'd been there, you might have gone. And then your dad probably would have been standing, because I would have picked him up afterwards. And I probably would have been standing right in that area where that bomb went off, which was basically that sort of foyer. But not just a foyer, it was the area where parents waited for their kids. You know, a concert like Ariana Grande, a lot of kids are going by themselves. You got mom and dad with the car outside.
12 kids under 16, right, so far confirmed.
Right, and so you got mom and dad with the car outside sitting there or going, you know, who's not done that, right? So you sit there and you wait for the damn thing to end. And then you went and stood in that area.
Yeah, sure.
And that was right where it... Yeah, it's just sort of unfathomable to me. It is unfathomable that the sort of the targeting of kids. It's like, have we really come to this now? I guess we have.
I guess so. And yet, you know, you touched on something that I opened the show with, and that is, so what are we going to do about that? I think this is our reality. Maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll, like some sort of ebb and flow, be less common in our lives. But I think this is going to be common in our lives. And I think the question is not, can we stop it? Because I'm not optimistic about that. I think the question is, what do we do about that? And my personal you know, mission is to still go to the Ariana Grande concerts.
Yes.
Is to still travel to Brussels, is to still go to the Cubs game, even yes. though they checked us, you know, kind of haphazardly at the game last night. I think we need to continue to do what we do.
Well, I was at, you know, I was at Steppenwolf last night. I went to see an Audra McDonald concert at Steppenwolf, and I'd seen all this right before it. It was a late show. It was like a 9 o'clock concert. And I'm there at Steppenwolf, and I'm watching all these people stream in, and I'm thinking there's, you know, no bag checks, no security whatsoever. And that's true, you know, pretty much.
Really? Here.
Yes, it's true. So I would say that in New York now, if you go to a show on Broadway, or certainly if you go to a concert at Madison Square Garden or something, then you get a lot of security. You get some security here at, I always noticed it at the Chicago Theater for comedy and music. But I would say the bulk of, you know, if you go to Hamilton or any of those shows, you're not seeing really the kind of security that would stop anything like this.
And what are you going to say if we do?
Well, I mean, how? I don't know. I mean, it's that equation of what price you're willing to pay to. I mean, who can, you know, the number of targets is so infinite, right? So if you say, once you say, okay, we'll target any soft target and we'll look for children, it's, there's too many places. You can't possibly secure all those places and have a life with any kind of freedom.
You know, I said that it was haphazard at the game last night. It wasn't haphazard, actually. It was thorough. You know, everybody was cooperating at Wrigley Field. Mm-hmm. But it was also not scary. You know, it was the furthest thing in the world from your mind. We see it as more an inconvenience than as something that might stop a terrorist from actually going into Wrigley Field. But you're right, the front of Wrigley Field, the front of Sox Park, the front of the theater is just as vulnerable as inside.
Right. I mean, and those are all, I mean, people make this argument with airport security, right?
Absolutely.
That, you know, we're absolutely secure once you're through the TSA, but when you're checking in.
Have you seen the lines before TSA? It's amazing.
Right.
And in fact, some people are now proposing that we actually make it, you can't get to the airport until you pass through a security check.
There's an argument for it.
And I suppose there is. Mm. And then we'll argue about it or bitch about it, and it will or won't be effective. But at the end of the day, I'm just thinking out loud and reminding myself that, you know, you're right, we can't stop it. How are you going to live your life? And it has to be going forward. Ariana Grande's concert continues. She's on the road. They're still touring.
You have no choice but to go forward. You have no choice. I mean, there's absolutely no alternative. But it's like the people that died have no, in any kind of thing like this, you always see a disconnect between the people who suffer on unimaginable pain and any feeling of connection or, you know, any connection to international affairs or to any of the causes for it. I would say in all of them, this one for me, maybe it's because I'm from there, so I admit that, but this disconnect feels the most outrageous. And I think for me, it's because the demographic for that concert is just so young. You know, her core of her fans are 14 years old. 14, you know, 13 or 12. I mean, good Lord, you know.
If there was ever any sense to these things, and there isn't. There's no fairness, there's no courage, there's no sense. But this is another level of senselessness,
isn't
it?
That's how it feels to me.
It's a 220. Chris Jones is in our studio, the Chicago Tribune critic, but also the Manchester native. I have a couple questions for you about other things that you've written about in the last couple of days. Do you got another minute?
Yeah, of course.
Stay right there. Your piece today about the circus had a quote in there that I thought, I love this quote. Also a good thing are the conversations and articles of Chris Jones, the critic whose story on the front page of the A&E section of the Chicago Tribune today is about the circus. How many times have you been to the circus in your life?
50-ish.
No kidding.
I went certainly
as a fan and as a critic.
Yeah, I've been every year for certainly 22, and I most years I saw the other company. Well, if you're looking at all circuses, I'm definitely, you know, a lot. I'm kind of a circus geek. I like the people. They live a life, my friend, of not rather different from yours and mine.
How so? Oh, come on. How
well,
so?
You know,
we ride horses.
I was talking to the ringmaster, who is the last ringmaster, who was
about quote I'm going to get to.
Yeah. What did he? Well, go ahead.
Finish your story.
All right. Okay. But he was just saying how everybody has a superpower. Is that one you're going to get to?
It's part of the same paragraph. But tell your story. You better you tell it than I.
But it's just everybody in the circus does one thing. You know, like the guy that, you know, does a quadruple somersault in the air, or the guy that whispers to a tiger or something. They do one thing. And and so it's like a sort of a Justice League.
Yeah, no kidding. And his superpower, he said, was, do you remember the quote?
No, tell me.
Well, here, but I like the quote for a different reason than maybe you do. The Last Ringmaster, you wrote, it sounds like a bad Spielberg movie, but this is the ringmaster himself sort of self-deprecatingly describing his role in the history of the circus when asked how it feels to be both the first African-American ringmaster of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus and the final ringmaster for the whole shebang. He said, quote, I'm a black man in America, so I take certain disappointments better than other people.
Yeah.
Every now and then there's a leap of perspective that just hits you in the face and you exactly. don't see it coming. And I thought, yeah, maybe you're better at this than I am.
Yes.
And then he said, everyone has their superpower. Mine is actually detachment. I'm the one with the steady hand in the circus of emotions. This guy's good copy.
He was very good copy. But, you know, he wasn't telling 100% the truth there, because his detachment, I could see that detachment was a thin veneer during that. You know, it's interesting, the journalists, if ever you interview people who are about to lose their jobs, they're always particularly frank.
And what have I got to lose?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and in entertainment, people are always worried about what the ramifications will be of whatever they might say to the likes of you or me, right? When they're up, when it's over, they give it to you.
But it is a type of entertainment whose time has come.
Yeah, I you know, there is a lot of issues. I was just saying this morning to some degree that it has the same problem. That one of the things that I thought that was interesting was that the circus was a general entertainment. So in other words, it had a bit of everything for everybody, and it was the big thing you went to. And people now, it's the same problem a printed newspaper has, frankly. It's or a department store. Now people want specific online channels for everything. They don't want
a big tent.
They don't want a big tent, and they don't want to be surrounded by people too much different.
I thought you're describing it as Macy's.
Yeah,
is so apt, and maybe Macy's will survive, but it's a struggle for all of those entities
it
out
is.
There. But was it the treatment of or the sense of the treatment of the animals that also doomed the circus?
I think without question that in large cities, among progressive young families, that the circus became sort of untenable in their view. Now, you know, it is an issue that always divides everybody. And in all my writing about circuses, I tried very hard to reflect both sides of that. The people at the circus vehemently deny mistreating animals. They think of themselves as having been destroyed by people trying to raise money on their backs. On the other hand, if you talk to the people who believe very passionately that wild animals should not be part of entertainment, and that it's true that, for example, you see animals doing unnatural things, and they, you know, have found evidence over the years of mistreatment. So I think it is a, you know, it's a very difficult issue in some ways. I think I've arrived at a place where I go, you know, the lions, the tigers, the elephants, the time has come for all of that to be gone. But I did look out at the last show, and I was watching his troupe of performing dogs having a good time. And I thought about my dog at home, cooped up in my place, and I'm thinking, you know, she'd have liked that.
She would have liked that. Better she
I can
do that.
Say
right.
That.
So I'm almost as guilty with a domesticated dog as these people are with domesticated wildlife.
Exactly.
And yet I don't want the animals to be mistreated. If you persuaded me that they are treated well, and I suspect they are, I mean, it's upon their backs that these people are making a living.
Yes.
So it would behoove them to treat the animals nicely. But I'm also kind of curious about what do the animals think of their lives? Treated
well. That's right. That's the million-dollar sort of unknowable in all of this. Is it what makes an animal happy? Is the tiger happy? And, of course, the tigers in this particular circus were bred by the trainer, right? So you could argue that no circus, that tiger wouldn't even be there because there would have been no reason to breed them, right?
Said the tiger.
Yeah. On the other hand, you can argue it's the most unnatural thing in the world. Then there's the argument, which the trainer made in the last show. He's arguing that if children in particular don't see, you know, a wildlife up front, they'll never care about it, to which animal rights people usually reply, well, you should then go see them in their natural surrounding, to which the circus replies, not everybody has $20,000.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Africa with the kids.
Right. It's complicated, John, like everything else.
It's nice to talk to you, Chris. I'm sorry that the circumstances are what they are that I asked you to come in, but I always enjoy talking to you about these other stories as well. Keep writing, and let's visit again.
All the best to you.
Chris Jones from Manchester, Once Upon a Time, now the Chicago Tribune critic. It's 2:30. This is WGN. Here on WGN Radio, so Steve just mentioned the One Summer Chicago 2017 effort that we're all involved with here. And remember, the online donation, you can make a donation online simply by going to onesummerchicago.org, O-N-E, onesummerchicago.org/donate, or pick up the phone and call 1-800-931-5707. And just like you make a donation for things or a purchase over the phone, they'll take your credit card number, and then the money will go into the kitty, which will be used to help hopefully over 30,000 young men and women, 14 to 24, find activity, find summer jobs this year in the city of Chicago. To talk a little bit more about this is Don Cook. He's the Senior Vice President of the McCormick Foundation. Don, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, John. It's great to see you. We're doing great. And thank you for having us and hosting us.
How long have you all been doing this?
Well, it's about 6 years now. And the mayor got behind this in a big way. And it's grown every year with both donations coming in as well as the city's own budget.
How much money do you need to fund 30,000 jobs?
$10 or $12 million, probably total.
Really, that much?
Yeah, yeah. It's not just the jobs. You know, one of the challenges with jobs is having the kids get there, or having clothing, having meals, and so on. So we pay those other costs as well, to so they can keep the money they make.
So the donations are coming in today, and will not just today. I mean, this is our main effort on this radio station today, but you can continue to make the donation tomorrow. What is your organization's role? You underwrite administrative expenses, things like that?
We do. The money comes into us, and working with the city, we find those agencies who are going to hire these kids, and we make grants out to them, as we do as a foundation.
What would an example be?
Well, Heartland Alliance, for example, is one of the great organizations in Chicago, and they work and hire a bunch of kids and put them out into different programs that they're running.
What would a job be?
Jobs could be anything from working inside the office to beautifying their communities, working outside, creating activities for kids, which could be basketball tournaments and marches and block parties and so on.
But there's organizations that have tasks that need people to do, and you're fitting these kids into those positions?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And a lot of the nonprofits love to have this help from the kids during the summer, but can't afford it themselves. And so the generous donations people make goes to helping those organizations.
Do the kids know about these jobs?
Yeah, the kids do. It's well publicized through the schools, and their kids who've been doing it for a few years, and they want to come back in and get another job.
How much do they get paid?
It's about $165 a week on average. But as I said, we also pay the extra costs so that they can keep that money. And if you think back to your first job or your summer jobs, how important that was both to have some money
But I'm doing the math here. 40 times 4, that's $4 an hour if I work 40 hours a week for $160 a week.
Yeah, well, the jobs aren't for 40 hours, so
I hope not.
They're smaller than that, yeah.
I guess, what's the objective here? To put money in the kids' pockets, to give them some, have a job and now you have money? Or to sort of give them the sense of accomplishment that a job provides?
Well, I think that all of those things. First of all, they do – the money is important, and they feel good that they're earning it, and that's terrific. But also the skills that go with having a job, getting to work on time, looking good, dealing with teams, dealing with bosses. I mean, these are skills that we all need and help you get on the right path as they grow up.
Do I understand correctly? I was talking to Todd Manley, our manager here, and he said that one of the things you guys anticipated is that maybe a kid in Austin – there's an opportunity for him in Northwest, but how's he going to get there? And that this sort of has anticipated that and has money for them to be able to find transportation.
That's right. We do want them to be able to move. We'd like it best if they can stay in their own communities, and of course that's where they build their pride and they have their network and so on. But there are times that kids cross neighborhoods to go to other jobs, and we want to help with that because that is a blow to the income, obviously, at this level.
Well, I think sometimes when we say, well, why don't you go get a job? And for those of us who have cars or enough means that we can pay for Uber whenever we want, other people aren't so fortunate. How am I going to take that job? Do the trains connect there? And then how much of a walk or a bus ride is it? And you could actually have people that want jobs and jobs not that far away, but they're so difficult to get to.
Yep,
what's your point?
That's right. And a bunch of the kids don't have driver's license, even if they had a car
available. Sure, now that you mention it, yeah.
So we want them on the public transportation getting where they need to go.
So this is all of us donating. These organizations, the Heartland Institute or whoever you described a moment ago, they don't have the budget for summer staff like this. So how are they going to get these kids but that we all donate the money?
Exactly. So it's a really great win for everybody. You know, the organizations do well, the communities do well, the kids do well, and of course our donors are super helpful and feel good about this.
The number to call to make a donation is 1-800-931-5707, 1-800-931-5707, onesummerchicago.org. Just go there if you want to make a donation online, onesummerchicago.org/donate. So all of us at the radio station have been describing our first summer jobs. What was yours? Do you remember?
Well, I was fortunate. I worked in the mornings for my dad, who had a publishing company, a small publishing company outside Philadelphia. But I was a great babysitter. But can you believe it? It was like 50 cents an hour or something.
Sure.
I remember what we were paying even when our kids needed babysitters. But it was great money, and I mowed lawns around the neighborhood and never stopped working until it was time to play baseball.
That's what play baseball and then what?
Well, then I was a kid, so I have to go home and go to bed.
I was going to say, you didn't turn pro, did you?
No,
did you?
No. Regrettably.
But my first job, the first time anybody ever gave me money to do something, which felt fantastic, by the way, would have been mowing a lawn or probably babysitting, you know. My first job where I actually had a W-2 would have been as a busboy at a restaurant in Joliet, W.C. Flicks. And that was terrific. I loved it. It was hard, miserable work. It was just grunt work. I was a busboy, but it was fantastic. And all the things you just described, you know, be to work on time, pay the price if you're not. You could get fired if you screw off too much, all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think dealing with other people in that kind of environment, which is different from your school friends and your neighborhood friends, but, you know, being a professional in a way and dressing up and doing the job is, you know, I think are all really important. You know, and the idea is get the kids, plus it keeps them safe, keeps them active and busy. And I remember talking to some of these kids a couple of years ago. You know, they were exhausted when they got home. They weren't going anywhere except to bed.
Yeah, now
they
mentioned
had to get up the next morning. So these are all important life skills, and I think it's a really fantastic program.
Well, and not to be cliche, it'll sound this way, but it also happens to be true. I must tell you that you have a sense of satisfaction when somebody gives you money, and it's good to have the money. But, you know, I worked, I had to wait, and then 2 weeks later, I got money for that. So there's a little gratification, delayed gratification, that is something that I think all of our kids could learn to benefit from. But the other thing, though, which is almost in some ways more meaningful than that, was the supervisor saying, good job.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who's not my mom or dad, and I was doing a good job, and they noticed it, and they said that. And all I'm doing is washing dishes and wiping tables. But that was a unique experience.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Up to that point in my life, you know, my mom and dad said good job, and I was doing a good job, but to have somebody else notice it outside the family was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's better than the parents coming home when you're babysitting and the kids are still alive.
I mean, exactly.
I think you're absolutely right. But that's an important part of growing up, and that's why this is such an important program for the city.
Okay, so here's what you need to do, and really do this. 1-800-931-5707. Make a phone call right now to 1-800-931-5707 or go online to onesummerchicago.org/donate. Donate as much as you can and know that in these hands, this money will be well spent. Any last thing you want to pass along?
No, I just want to thank you and the team here for jumping on this in such a big way. We're proud to be part of it. We don't take any money from this, so all the money gets used for the kids, and so this is important and important to our kids.
I was the best dishwasher they may have ever had at W.C. Flicks. I really worked hard, I really fast, and I challenged myself. When they would come in with the stacks of dishes and stuff and all of the food and the napkins and back then cigarette butts, I would try and get rid of it as quickly as I could. And they said, John, that's good, But if you go too fast, you'll put too much stuff in that industrial disposal. And if it backs up, everything comes back up into the kitchen. I'm like, oh, don't worry about that. I won't do that. But sometimes I would. One day, I was just killing it back there. And one of the guys in the kitchen go, man, you are unbelievable. I'm like, yeah, I am Mr. Dishwasher. He says, I'm going to go get Dean, the manager, and I'm going to go show him that. He went away. And just then, the entire plumbing system threw up through the disposal into the kitchen, and they came in, and hours worth of sludge had now come through into the kitchen and all over. And I'm just standing there, and he walks in. He looks at me. He says nothing. He pivots and walks out. Now, there's a valuable lesson to be learned there. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure there was a valuable lesson to have been learned there.
Well, it was fairly disgusting, but do you do the dishes now is the question?
No, I do not. Are you kidding me? I have people do that. Keep up the good work. Nice to see you.
Thanks, John. Thanks so much.
Don Cook's the Senior Vice President of the McCormick Foundation. And please make a phone call. If you've got questions or comments about it, let us know. Here at WGN, on WGN, this is John Williams. I see Violetta Pradomatic and Kevin are getting ready for traffic and sports. When Roe and what's the tall lady that comes in with him every day and does this show? Anna DeVlantis, when they come in. I have a quiz question for you guys. Violetta, how many new species were discovered last year? Kevin, if you want to play at home, you play on the radio, you can too. How many new species of plant and animal were discovered last year? New species. Species discovered last
probably
year.
Probably much more than I think.
I can be a lifeline, by the way.
Do I get a 50-50 situation?
By that we mean, okay, I'll give you,
maybe an over-under. How about an over-under?
Okay, over-under 10,000. Over 10,000 or under 10,000?
I'll say over.
You say over 10,000. Violetta, go. Oh, hold on. Do I not have Violetta turned up? There you are, Violetta.
I knew you guys weren't listening to me. I've been talking this whole time.
She's always talking, though, John, so don't be offended.
Do they do that sometimes, Violetta, just turn you off while you're in mid-sentence or something?
I wish I would notice more. I kept talking. I was like, okay,
you were really
anyway.
Killing it, weren't
yeah,
you? But
I really
nobody was responding.
Used all my zingers.
10,000, Violetta, zingers. Over, under.
New species.
I feel like I was going to say over two, so he stole my answer. My mic was off, so that's not fair.
Sorry.
Fair game.
I guess I'll just say the opposite. Under,
yeah, just
under.
To be a team player. Yeah. It's 18,000. 18,000 new species.
That's like fungus and mold, right?
One of them, yeah, I know some of them aren't that interesting. The spiny ant, but it's a really cool ant. And then there's some little moths and beetles that look like the leaves they're on, and they're fantastic. But
the katydid?
Yeah, it's like.
Sorry, but I love the name.
There is a katydid on here. There's also, though, the root eating island rat. So it's a whole rat. I mean, you think we'd have figured out all the rats by now.
Yeah.
And by the way, ew is not exactly the nicest way to welcome a new species to
Well,
to
we're trying to get rid of other species like that.
Yeah, I thought every species of rat resided in Chicago.
How did we not know? The king of all freshwater stingrays, a big old 43-inch long stingray in fresh water, which would be kind of weird. The bush tomato, there's a bush that has tomato plants on it that bleed, and the list goes on. A new kind of orchid and all kinds of things. But I'm just, you know, you think that
Are
by now...
Are they all on this planet?
Yes. What with their... Violetta, I'm going to let you walk that back. All life is on Earth. We have not discovered any life on any other planet.
I just wanted to make that clear to the listeners.
That wasn't a silly slip. You knew that. You were just making sure. For instance, Judy Pilak was thinking, well, what about all of the Martian ones? But you were helping her out on that. And I think that's
I'm
really
always
nice.
Looking out.
Well, I do actually have a story, though, about the moon. And I'm running out of time now, so I won't talk about it today. We will tomorrow or the next day. We are in line to interview Nancy Lee Carlson from Inverness. She is the lady that bought online at auction that bag that Neil Armstrong had on the moon with the moon dust in it. Isn't that the most amazing thing? I was talking about this on my Saturday show a little bit, and now I'm reading the press release from Sotheby's. I talked to them off the air today, too. And it's just amazing that she saw online the Marshal Service, because of a court case, had confiscated items that they believe had been stolen. So now the Marshal Service has the bag that Neil Armstrong put artifacts in on the moon, and they're now auctioning it off, which is just kind of weird. And twice it was online at auction, and nobody bid anything. And then this one attorney from around here goes, oh, well, if that's the real thing, I'll bet that's worth more than $900. There were some other items in the group as well. She bought them all for just under $1,000, and now they're going to auction it off for $2 to $4 million. $2 to $4 million. They say it does contain some dust from the earth, little tiny, teeny, weeny particles. Not the sort of thing you'd put in a trophy case, but the bag is pretty cool. It says Lunar Sample Return on it. What a story. Anna DeVlantis is in the studio.
Hi there, John.
Enjoys this too. Ro, what are you doing over there?
I'm playing with something. Unfortunately, I was always told by my parents never to do that.
Don't play with fire either. That's another thing.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. I was pressing buttons I shouldn't have been pressing. So
what's on your show today, kids?
Well, let's just say that there's a lot because the news warrants. But we're going to spread it out. We got all kinds of things happening here, and we want to share as much as we possibly can with the world. Obviously, we just had John Brennan, former CIA director. He was up on Capitol Hill earlier. Now Mike Rogers is about to get up on Capitol Hill and testify. Brennan's testimony was quite interesting, I thought. It said
you've been
a few
watching
things.
It?
Yeah.
It was interesting. Well, he revealed some things for the first time.
Like what?
Like saying that he was concerned about possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. And yeah. It struck him at the time, and he was considering making moves to deal with it.
You know what's kind of sad is that you go, okay, testimony today, investigation is very fascinating, and I'm thinking, okay, which one was which one is this? I wasn't
which
exactly.
One?
I
try
know.
To keep him straight.
I'm like, oh yeah, I know what's going on, but I'm not sure which one we're even talking about. Which is,
right,
that's a bad sign.
Yes.
Then there's the budget, too, we got to deal with, which is $2 trillion in mystery money sitting in the middle of that. No one knows where it's going to come from, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
that'll come from somewhere.
Yeah, it's even weirder than we thought. When you see the budget, they put that Mulvaney guy on, who's now the director of Office of Management and Budget, and they put him in Sean Spicer's podium,
uh-huh.
You know, the one that has wheels and goes
and attack people in any given moment.
And oh my god, it was unbelievable. It was like he took on like a whole kind of spicy thing. He was kind of, you know, yelling at the people, and I'll take you. And you know who kept asking questions was Sputnik Television, the Russians.
What?
Are you
Sputnik.
Kidding me? Are you
no.
serious?
I'm like, how did they get in there to do that?
Did they identify themselves, Sputnik Television?
Yes, Sputnik. Yes, this one.
They got satellite ears. They got antenna coming out of their nose, or something like that.
We would like to know how budget is going to affect our relationship with President Trump.
It was really weird. And Mulvaney's like pointing at him. And so we'll play some of that for you.
It's almost awesome, the brazenness of this administration. They don't give a lick about your optics. You think that looks bad? They don't care. In fact, now they're going to do it twice as hard just because they know you think that looks weird. It's amazing.
It is.
It's amazing. It's almost encouraging. I have to stop talking now. You guys do a real good show.
All right.
Thank you, John. We'll try our best.